Should we start? Okay. Everyone ready? Good afternoon. Welcome to the session. Welcome on behalf of the Global HIV Prevention Working Group. Thank you for coming this afternoon. I'm Jen Cates. I'm with the Kaiser Family Foundation, Director of HIV Policy there, and also a member of the Global HIV Prevention Working Group. The Prevention Working Group is a panel of over 50 experts from around the world who are focused on prevention. It's co-convened by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Kaiser Family Foundation. And today we're releasing a new report that's focused on behavior change in HIV prevention. And it's entitled Behavior Change in HIV Prevention Reconsiderations for the 21st Century. And we chose this topic for this report very purposefully. Because we feel, and the Global HIV Prevention Working Group felt, that behavioral HIV prevention needed to have some more focus, that it was an area, one of the most critical areas in HIV prevention, and we wanted to bring additional attention to it. You should have received in your folders our press release, a copy of the executive summary of the report, as well as a flash drive. The flash drive contains not only the full report, but all of the other reports from the Prevention Working Group, which are also available on our website. We have three speakers here today who are all part of the Global HIV Prevention Working Group, and each will be talking about different aspects of the report. I'm going to briefly say who's here, and then we'll let them each speak and open it up for your questions. First, we have Dr. Helene Gale, who's the co-chair of the Global HIV Prevention Working Group and president and CEO of CARE USA, and has been part of this working group since its inception. We also have Dr. Judy Auerbach, a working group member and deputy executive director for science and public policy at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. And then finally, we have Dr. Salim Abdul Karim, another working group member and pro vice chancellor for research at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. So we'll begin with our speaker remarks and then, as I mentioned, open it up to you. Dr. Gale, please start us off.
Great. Thanks, Jen. And it's a pleasure to be here to speak about this report. And as Jen mentioned, this is part of a series of reports that the Prevention Working Group has released. And this one focused on behavioral prevention. Other reports have focused on other aspects of prevention. And I hope you'll have the opportunity to look at some of the other reports. If there's one key finding from this report, it's that programs to promote behavior change are highly effective for preventing HIV, and they must be urgently expanded. And when we talk about behavior change, we're talking about reducing behaviors that put people at risk for HIV, including unsafe sex and drug use. For the report, we carefully reviewed hundreds of scientific studies assessing behavior change programs, and the overwhelming conclusion is that these programs work and can have a dramatic impact on preventing HIV infections. In all cases in which national HIV epidemics have been reversed, broad-based behavior change was central to that success. Review of national prevention programs that include evidence-based behavior change strategies show that they have been associated with an overall 50 to 90% decline in HIV infections in key populations. Yet despite this strong evidence, many have been skeptical about the effectiveness of behavioral HIV prevention programs. This concern is clearly misplaced, and we shouldn't confuse the difficulty in changing human behavior with the inability to do it. Behavior change has been with us since the start of this epidemic, and it's still one of the most important tools we have. The key challenge with behavior change programs is not that they aren't effective, but they don't reach the people who need them the most. Today, fewer than 1 in 5 people at high risk for HIV worldwide have access to effective prevention programs that are tailored to their needs. By expanding effective prevention, including behavior change programs, we could save millions of lives. Projections commissioned by our working group showed that expanding all the scientifically proven HIV prevention strategies could cut global rates of HIV prevention in half by 2015. Expanding behavioral prevention is especially important since we know that a vaccine or microbicide or other biomedical tools will not be available in the near future and will take much longer than we all have hoped for. As the report notes, it is challenging to design effective behavior change programs, monitor their impact, and we know that additional research is needed in these areas. For example, more research is needed on how to translate findings from controlled prevention trials into real-world settings and how to sustain that behavior change for the long haul. But let me be clear, unanswered questions shouldn't stop us from supporting behavioral change programs. The report makes a number of recommendations for improving and expanding behavior change programs. There are three of these particularly that I'll mention. First, international funders should meet UNAIDS calls for at least $11.9 billion to be spent annually by 2010 to expand HIV prevention efforts, including behavior change programs targeted at groups at highest risk. Second, leaders in developing nations seriously affected by HIV/AIDS should work closely with UNAIDS, the World Health Organization, to develop aggressive national HIV prevention plans that are based on the latest scientific evidence. And third, researchers should undertake additional studies to address limitations in knowledge about how best to implement behavior change programs. Thank you, and I will turn it over to Judy.
Thanks, Helene. Can you hear me in this? Through this? Thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the evidence that demonstrates the efficacy and the effectiveness of behavioral change because, as Helene said, in all cases in which national HIV epidemics have been reversed or reduced, and this is also true for early epicenters like San Francisco, the city from which I come, behavior change was central to success. And in the report, we review two key types of evidence for effective behavioral change. The first coming from randomized control trials, which are still considered the most rigorous experimental methodology, the gold standard method in biomedical and prevention science. And from this literature, we find in the report, as have others who've reviewed it before us, that hundreds of randomized control trials have been conducted and evaluated over the past 25 years and have demonstrated that individual, small group, and community-level interventions can produce behavioral changes that reduce the risk for HIV transmission and acquisition. And these kinds of trials generally demonstrate moderate effects on the order of about 20 to 30% risk reductions, measured out as long as about 2 years post-intervention, and they've shown efficacy in a range of geographical settings and population groups throughout the world. The second type of evidence that we review and describe in the Prevention Working Group report comes from observational research, and this includes analyses of epidemiologic trends, case control studies, and other kinds of methodologies that allow comparisons without experimental randomization. Observational data, as Helene mentioned, have provided the evidence for the efficacy and effectiveness of behavioral change strategies employed by individuals, communities, governments, and civil society organizations in reducing HIV incidence and prevalence in such diverse places as Australia, Brazil, Senegal, Thailand, Uganda. And these strategies include condom promotion, for example, the 100% condom use program in Thailand, partner reduction campaigns like the zero grazing campaign in Uganda, the implementation of harm reduction programs like syringe exchange and access programs in Australia, and frank, sexually explicit public awareness campaigns such as those in Brazil. And there's actually a third type of behavior change evidence that's discussed in particularly a sidebar in the report, and that is the behavioral change that occurs as a result of the standard of prevention that's provided in HIV clinical prevention trials for biomedical technologies. And a number of these recent biomedical technologies trials, including the STEP vaccine trial you've heard a lot about in the last year, the Caraguard microbicide trial, the MIRA diaphragm study, and so on, produced effectively null findings. That is, there was no evidence of efficacy of the particular products under study. And much of the explanation for that lack of finding of efficacy of the product had to do with the uptake of behavioral change by both the control and the experimental groups in these trials, such that no independent effect of the product under study could be discerned. Now, many people describe these trials as having failed. But although they failed in demonstrating efficacy of the product under study, they actually succeeded in demonstrating the efficacy of behavioral counseling, condom promotion and access, and STI diagnosis and treatment and management. So in the end, the standard of prevention is actually a behavioral change intervention that is proving to be quite efficacious. And from all these sources of evidence, it's clear that one size does not fit all. Effective interventions and programs take different forms, and they must be culture, population, and setting appropriate. At the same time, there are some commonalities we describe in the report across behavioral change interventions, and these include they provide essential information and education about HIV transmission and associated behaviors, actions, and settings. They develop motivation to engage in risk reduction. They provide skills for engaging in that risk reduction, whether those are technical skills of how to put on a condom or negotiation skills of how to encourage condom use with your partner. They provide access to the means of protecting oneself and one's partners, like distributing condoms or sterile syringes. And they provide a supportive environment in which to make and hopefully sustain behavioral changes. Effective programs at the community or nation level also have some things in common. If these are programs as opposed to individual interventions, they deliver a combination of evidence-based risk reduction strategies. They ensure access by achieving sufficient coverage, sufficient intensity, and duration to have a long-term impact. They're tailored to specific needs and circumstances of groups at the greatest risk and the main drivers of HIV transmission among them. That is, they are contextualized. They have strong community engagement and support, and they have support from political and other social leaders. All this being said, there are still significant limitations, gaps, and challenges in behavioral prevention research and programs, as we describe in the report. And to discuss some of these, I would like to turn things over to Dr. Abdul Karim. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judy. So as somebody who runs a large treatment program and a very large-scale prevention effort in rural communities in South Africa, I can tell you exactly how many patients we've taken through our VCT program. I can tell you exactly how many of those patients initiated antiretroviral therapy, what their adherence is by pill count. I can tell you what proportion have an undetectable viral load, in other words, treatment success, and I can tell you what the mortality is. I just wish I could tell you the same about our success in prevention. And that has been one of the big challenges in undertaking research in prevention. Now, we know that we are making headway in prevention. We know we are able to change the course of the epidemic within our particular context by using an approach of combining all the evidence that we have. But there are three challenges that we experience in undertaking research that is highlighted in the report that I want to just touch on. The first is that in prevention research, we are measuring a non-event. In other words, we're measuring something that didn't occur. And we would love to stand on our soapbox and say, here's all the infections we prevented. And of course, the critics would say, well, how do you know you prevented those? And the reality is that it's hard for us to convey that notion of something that didn't happen, when we know, in fact, that our prevention efforts are having the kind of success we want. But we know it's difficult. If it was easy, we wouldn't have an epidemic. And we know the challenges, and we are getting now a much clearer understanding of what have been the challenges that we need to overcome to achieve success. And those are some of the aspects captured very well in this report. The second point I want to make, so besides the challenges in measuring a non-event, the second point I want to make is about the challenges of taking evidence, whether it is evidence from clinical trials or observational studies or from what we've seen, for example, our wonderful experiences of the data and understanding the nature of the epidemic in Uganda. In Senegal, where they've had amazing success, to translate evidence into real-world implementation has enormous challenges. Let's take circumcision. We've seen in 3 clinical trials the most compelling evidence of any prevention intervention that circumcision works. However, the implementation of circumcision, and I see it in my own communities where my own research center is, the challenges of implementing it, not least the health service infrastructure to be able to do this, the ability to implement, to get men to take up this intervention, have been enormous challenges. But that's what we have to study. Those are not issues we can turn our backs on. That is part of the prevention research agenda, that we need to take up the challenge and look at what does it mean to translate a research finding into real-world practice. In fact, we see it very successfully in therapeutic pharmaceuticals. There are, 60, 70 drugs to treat hypertension. How does a drug company get the 71st drug instituted into the psyche and corner a market share? Well, they have a way of diffusing that. They go to key doctors, they get them to do phase 4 trials, get them experience with prescribing the drug, dealing with it, and the next time a patient comes in, that's the drug they prescribe. That's part of what we need to do. We need to diffuse our interventions into the healthcare service. We need to get the healthcare services to participate in monitoring the impacts of the epidemic, and we need a way in which the early adopters can show the way to the rest of the healthcare service. And the third point I want to make is that we've seen over and over. In fact, when I go back to the first presentation I gave at one of these conferences about the challenges in prevention, and I said, we know that knowledge and motivation is not enough. In other words, we know that many of the people who are getting infected know their risk of getting infected, and they're motivated to not getting infected. It's we don't understand the context and the structural issues that impact on behavior. And in fact, there are many, that's not unique to HIV. There are superb studies. Take the studies that have been done on water boiling, that when NGOs went into a rural community and educated everybody about the importance of boiling water to prevent diarrhea, something like 10% of the households took up that intervention because they just didn't understand the challenges of getting wood, of getting the fire going, what that meant. So in the same way, we haven't understood what is it going to take for us to get the known prevention into it? What is it going to take for us to get condom use rates higher? And we've seen, for example, in the migrant labor situation in the context where I come from, that the husband comes home on a Friday night, he's there just once a month, and the first thing he does, he stops off at the shebeen and he's drunk by the time he gets home and he wants to have sex. Try to get a condom onto a drunk man's penis. Now, that's a challenge worth taking on. So, I just want to make the point that it's one thing to give messages and to sell the ideas. It's another thing to understand the context and to enable those interventions and those behaviors to take hold and to be implemented in real life. So on that note, I'd like to hand back to Jen.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all of our presenters. One thing I want to say before we open it up for your questions, when we first co-convened and formed the Global HIV Prevention Working Group in 2002, it was at a time when there was some concern that there might not be as much of a focus on prevention as there needed to be. And I'm happy to say today, it seems like from the dialogue at this conference and from a lot of what we hear, that there is a much greater emphasis and focus on the critical need for HIV prevention. But we're still at a point of trying to understand what does that mean, what are the challenges, and how do we implement the things that we know. So I encourage you all to read the report, because I think it's an honest look at these challenges in a way that is helpful for moving forward. I'm going to stop and open it up now for questions of our speakers here, or anything you want to say on the report.
Gus Naismith from the United States, the Rutland Herald in Vermont. I kept looking around because I prefer someone from a developing country make the question I am, and that is, one, it's heartening to hear your assurance that prevention is possible, which some people seem to give up on, and I think the report's valuable. But I have been and asked with grassroots people in developing countries, And their challenge in prevention is people, they are effective outreach people. I've been with them, especially in the marginalized groups, as they effectively have behavior change. But they don't get funding, and often they're told by UN agencies or others, we need to do more research. And I'll tell you, I left Nepal in March, report that a development set, which we all may be, $700 a day researcher sitting in the Radisson Hotel wanted to pay transgender and MSM in a culture where it's dangerous to go out and do further data collection. These people knew the data, but they don't have the abilities to do the kind of reports and things you do. So how do those doing effective grassroots preventive works that they know works, would you be lobbyists for them in getting more direct funding rather than people waiting?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the recommendations, as I mentioned in the report, is that we need to have the adequate resources. UNAIDS estimate is that about $11.9 billion annually by 2010 is what's necessary for prevention, and a lot of those resources would get out to the kinds of groups that you're talking about. I mean, I think one of the things that we try to highlight in this report is that, you know, while we know what works and we know and we've seen successful programs, there are few places in the world where prevention has been scaled up so that there's the kind of saturation, if you will, that can have the population impact that we think it can have. And so resources are critical, getting them to the right community, getting them into the right hands, getting them into the hands of the people who know how to do prevention, and doing it better and more effective. Those are all the sorts of things that we feel are necessary if we're going to have an impact, taking the things that we know do work and can make a difference, but scaling them up and making sure they're actually reaching people. You know, again, as I said, that 1 in 5 people who are at high risk for HIV are estimated to have access to prevention strategies, and the right ones. And so, you know, I think that's our core, in some ways, our core challenge is to have the resources to make sure that we can scale up the programs we know work.
If I could just add a point around the evidence question. I think part of what we're trying to say here and others of us in other venues is that evidence is derived from different sources. And so the people you're describing who are in the fields and leading programs should be generating evidence around behavioral change that's effective in their communities and in their settings, as well as taking evidence that's derived elsewhere and seeing how it might be applied. So I think from a resource question, we'd also like to see the funding and the support available to make more rigorous the findings from community-derived knowledge and interventions that can be constituted as evidence that we all can learn from.
Another question? Everyone is speechless. Okay.
Dave Ellison, the Bay Area News Group and the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. I'm just curious, hitherto, what have been the problems in getting more attention and getting these programs implemented? Is it a question of lack of funding? Is it a question of ideology? Is it a question that people have put more hope into vaccines, and now that those are proving so much more difficult, now they're finally seen more interest here? What has been the problem in the past primarily?
Yeah, well, I don't think that there is any one answer. I think all of those things account for why prevention hasn't been on the radar screen and hasn't had the focus that it should. I think that clearly, in some ways, just as Slim started out his story, it is much easier to make tangible treatment. And I think all of our natural inclination as human beings is to see somebody who is sick and want to help them. We now have something we can do that can make a huge difference for the lives of people who are already infected with HIV. And so I think there is, you know, there's the tangible nature of treatment that really does make it easier in many ways to provide support for that. I think the fact that prevention is controversial in many ways, the fact that it is linked to things that societies don't want to deal with, sexual behaviors, drug use, same-sex behavior, all the factors that are related, sex work, you know, all the things that make this very controversial and make it difficult. I think it's also the fact that behavior change is difficult. You know, we look at anything. If we look at smoking patterns, if we look at seatbelt use, you know, there's not anything that we've done that requires behavior change that hasn't taken a long time and is as complicated. And none of those things are as complicated as changing sexual behaviors. And as you know, several of the as the other two panelists have said, sexual behavior takes place in a context. And so while on one hand behavior change is focused on individuals, we know that there's a variety of things that really influence sexual behavior, individual behavior, that we also have to look at. You know, are people, are women who are poor, who have no other options but transactional sex, are they able to change their individual behavior if we aren't changing what's the driver for putting herself at risk and vulnerability to begin with? So I think it's all of those sorts of things that make this incredibly complicated. But again, as we try to point out in the report, just because it's complicated, just because it's not easy, doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. And we shouldn't use the excuse of the difficulty of doing behavioral prevention as an excuse for not doing something that we know can save millions of lives.
I can just add.
Just add one additional point. Is that fine? No.
Good.
Well, I have a loud voice, so I actually don't need
you're
this.
Okay. You're right.
So I just want to add one additional point, and that is that there's something about immediacy of, you know, looking into the eyes of a patient that you know is going to die in the next 3 months if we don't do something. There's something about that need to act, that we as the medical profession feel the immediacy to do something to alter that course. There isn't that same sense of immediacy when a young 18-year-old comes into the rooms and is looking for contraception. There isn't that same immediacy to intervene in that setting. There's also a lot of judgmental attitudes that it's really your fault that you're going to get infected. You know, there's that victim-blaming kind of paradigm that even 27 years into the epidemic, we still see. And those are part of the challenges that we have to deal with. Those are part of the obstacles we have to overcome so that prevention is seen, you know, on par, if not more important than what we do in treatment. And I see it because I have a program where I'm treating about 6,000 people with AIDS. And I see the importance that if we don't do prevention as much as we do in treatment, or even more, what we're doing is simply not even going to capture the growing epidemic. Forget just trying to reach people who are already infected. Just the newly infected will just swamp the program. So we have to see them as things that are not separate, but they are part of the continuum, and they need to both be done with the same kind of energy and gusto.
To add one more thing from the report that the report touches on, and many other documents that have been released recently talks about rethinking how we even conceptualize prevention. We don't always conceptualize prevention as something that should occur throughout a person's life, throughout their life cycle, throughout the life cycle of a population. Yet we do easily think about that for treatment. So we think that somebody is HIV positive and needs treatment. They may go on a treatment at a certain point. They may be on a complex regimen, and at some point they may need to switch that regimen because it's not working, it doesn't work for them in terms of side effects, or it's not controlling their virus. A new treatment becomes available, and that gets switched in. But we don't have the same conceptualization for prevention, that prevention is not one thing. It's a combination of things, and it may change over time as new information comes into play or things about somebody's life change. So the report talks a little bit about prevention for someone's life, but also other reports that have come out.
Final thing about the implementation question you asked about ideological or political opposition. Helene said a lot about the sensitivities around the kinds of transmission routes for HIV infection and the people who are most affected by that. There's sort of benign lack of implementation. There's also, or implementing not necessarily the right thing, there's also very active problem with not implementing evidence-based prevention, and that has to do with denial. I mean, actually denial of the transmission denial of the populations who are most effective, whether you call that stigma and discrimination or homophobia. But I think that all of us would acknowledge that some of the lack of implementation has not just been because the subject's difficult and complicated. It's because people who are in positions to make a difference, political leaders and so on, don't want to make a difference.
Are there other questions?
Yeah, Andrew Jack, Financial Times. I just wondered if you could disaggregate a little bit the positive correlation, you know, the success of prevention programs. If you look at the MSM community, I mean, just strikes me, that's pretty striking. You look at some of the richest areas of the world, very highly educated group, some of the earliest and most active interventions that, you know, seem to work, and accessibility, condoms and so on, and yet, you know, the highest rates of new infection today. So what's failing in that group? And is the data still positive there or not?
Yeah, I don't think I would say things are failing. It's a question of sustainability, which I know Slim had on his list, and he probably was sensitive to time and didn't say much about. But one of the key challenges for the field and for all of us who are concerned about epidemics everywhere is sustaining the effective results we've seen from behavioral change, whether those are a result of rigorous scientifically derived interventions or community mobilized behavioral change. And so with gay men around the world, we've seen sort of peaks and fallows in risk and infection rates that have a lot to do with the sustainability of the kinds of interventions that have been emerged. So it says to us that have been developed, it says to all of us as a field that we have to be creative, we have to kind of reconstitute ourselves and our approaches over time, because we are talking about sustaining behavioral change in social contexts that change a lot and over lifetimes.
It's both sustaining the response throughout the community, but it's also making sure it's sustained for any given individual. Again, I think what Jen said, you know, we often look at somebody who might have had access to services and maybe really focused on prevention at one point in their life, who becomes infected, and say that's a failure of prevention. Well, that's a failure of the fact that we didn't continue to meet the prevention needs for that individual. And we're not continuing to meet the prevention needs for individuals and meeting the prevention needs for communities. So I think it's that notion, just like we realize we have to continue treatment for somebody's life, how do you do the same sort of sustained over the course of a lifetime sustaining of a prevention response? And I think we don't think enough of that notion.
I think we have time for one or two other questions.
Is this on? Hi, my name is Tim Rogers from the Tico Times newspaper in Costa Rica. If I'm asking you to repeat anything, I apologize. I've been stuck in line for a hot dog for about 40 minutes. I'm wondering if you think that the promise of a vaccine has deterred enthusiasm for prevention plans, if people's confidence in science is that the attitude is we'll fix it once it's broke rather than keeping it from happening in the first place.
So I can say, hello. So the question you're asking relates to whether there's a sort of general sense that science is going to solve this problem, and so do we need to change our behavior now? And it relates to both proven and unproven interventions. So I think the report touches on the issue of behavioral disinhibition, which is the broad rubric under which this falls. But I think it doesn't go into it in specific terms that you are relating to. But I can just say that it does touch on the fact that if you don't sustain and ensure that you've conveyed your message in an appropriate way in terms of knowing the epidemic and the challenges that are being faced, then you create the opportunity for misinformation to take hold. And that's part of our challenge. Part of our challenge is to ensure that what we're doing is evidence-based, and that the evidence-based approaches dominate the paradigm and convey the information that's required. And I think if I just look at within that context, I have not seen that perception, even within trial populations, where we are undertaking trials of microbicides and vaccines. Having done the Pombili trial, the step equivalent in South Africa, we just don't see that. We don't see people thinking that they're getting the vaccine and therefore changing their behavior. Condom use in both arms of the study remained equivalent, in fact slightly higher, than what we saw in the pre-trial cohorts. So we don't see that effect.
But I think at a societal level, we do feel that, though. I mean, I think you're right at an individual level, because that's, you know, we see that in trials, in fact, people do adhere to prevention. But I think at a societal level, there is a sense of we don't really have to do this hard work, because eventually a magic bullet is going to be found. Eventually we're going to have that vaccine. Eventually we're going to have the microbicide PrEP or whatever. And I think the message that we've tried to say over and over again from this prevention working group is, even when we find biomedical tools, which we badly need, we're going to have to continue to do the hard work of changing behaviors. And that has to be the foundation of our prevention work. And biomedical tools will not substitute for continuing to have a focus on behavioral prevention. So I think at a societal level, even if not at an individual level, we are still, you know, kind of naively thinking that some magic bullet is going to keep us from having to do the hard work of changing behaviors.
Just to add one final comment on that regard, the report, as Jen mentioned, I think is particularly good, because it's very honest. It's an honest appraisal of where we are in the field. And if we have learned nothing else in this epidemic, it's that the pandemic is in fact quite nuanced, and that some things work for some people in some settings over some period of time. So any of these attempts to sort of distill prevention into one strategy or another, or will, you know, once we have a vaccine, people will stop using condoms, we just know is not really the way to be thinking about the response to this pandemic.
Walt Singerfit from CHAMP and AIDS2008.com. I'm wondering if either or all of the panel could offer any strategic advice and terms of targeting about what would be, over the next 2 years before the next conference, the two or three most important strategic goals and institutional targets to help change the policy and funding environment to permit the wider implementation of what your report recommends.
I'll just quickly say, from my point of view as a social scientist, I'd like to see the research establishment and the funders of research broaden the spectrum to be much more inclusive and supportive of social science research in combination with behavioral research and biomedical research. Because even though everybody talks about, and we allude in this report, although it's focused on behavior and change, it's behavioral change in social context, but the science for the social context part of it has been underdeveloped and underexplored, as even at this conference, you'll hear in every talk, people are coming up against it and referring to it. So my key intervention and the change that I'd like to see in the next couple of years is a much more robust invention and the products of social science research.
If I can just say that you know, we trumpet our successes in treatment. We need to find a way to build the capacity of all those many organizations, NGOs, and groups that are doing amazing work in prevention. All we hear is that prevention doesn't work. All we hear is the bad news. We're not getting the information. We're not getting the evidence from those who are achieving success. And I think that it's important that we see that as part and parcel of the information base on which we make the decisions as we go forward.
I would agree with all of those and just add that, you know, I think I would also like to see that we take seriously the business of scaling up prevention, just like we've taken seriously the business of scaling up treatment, and that we do it in the same professional way, looking at what are the human resource costs, what are the human resource needs, what are the capacity needs, what are the managerial and operational needs, and really look at prevention in the same kind of professional way that we look at treatment and the scale up of it in as serious and as rigorous a way. And I think if we do that, then we're going to start to see the kinds of successes. We'll be able to build from it and learn from it and do the kind of research we need to do even a better job.
Ruth Pollard from the Sydney Morning Herald. You mentioned circumcision and condoms in the same breath in the prevention debate these days. And apart from an almost complete lack of political will on the part of governments, one of the major problems with condoms has been men's unwillingness to adopt them. Why do we think men are going to be any more likely to agree to have a delicate piece of skin sliced off their penis than they have been to adopt condoms?
Well, there's evidence that shows, in fact, men do, and that given the information that, in fact, it could protect them from getting HIV, they are very eager, in fact, to get circumcised. So all the data suggests that with the right evidence and the right kind of outreach, men, in fact, are very interested in having something that will protect them from getting HIV.
And there, too, it's not all men, but it's more men than I think a lot of us thought. There is some counterintuitive evidence emerging from cultures where we thought for religious grounds or cultural grounds, certain men would object to male circumcision because it has meaning as identifying with some other kind of person than you are. It's turning out that's not true. I think another part of the answer is it's presumably a single use or one-time operation that could be protective for a lifetime. And finally, there are men who truly believe, because the nuances of the data are not easily to communicate about the 50 to 60% efficacy level does not mean 100% effective, there are plenty of men who will be quite happy to not use condoms and would rather have a circumcision as a result.
Just to say that from the two experiences that have been quite well documented, the one from Orange Farm, where one of the three trials was undertaken, once the information about the results of the Orange Farm trial went out into the community as part of the dissemination process, they were inundated. And in fact, they now have a whole program in place where they bring in physicians to do the circumcisions. And they've now been scaling it up on scale within Orange Farm. And that's really based on demand driven rather than being imposed. And the second is data that comes out of Swaziland, which shows substantial uptake. In fact, people are talking about now the waiting lists that are being created for men who want to have circumcision. So there is a demand that's being created. And I think it'll be a big enough challenge for us just to meet that demand, let alone, you know, attempt to get every man circumcised. And I want to make one last point, and that is that in much of Southern Africa, where the epidemic is most substantial, circumcision, in fact, was widely practiced until it was banished. And it was Shaka himself who banished it as something that, you know, he needed his young men to be fighting, and he didn't want to have them away and out of the field because they went for traditional circumcision. So, in fact, it's within many of the cultures to circumcise. So it's not as if it's something foreign being imposed. It is something that they used to do that was stopped along the way in their history that we are now talking about reintroducing.
Other questions?
Afternoon.
Yeah, I think this will be the last one. Last question.
My name is Jamila Taylor with the Center for Health and Gender Equity, and I just wanted to follow up on the question about male circumcision and wondering if you all have any information about the information that women are getting on the ground about circumcision and how it may impact their relationships.
Well, there's lots of components to that. And I think that all of us have a responsibility to, at the very least, convey what the evidence about male circumcision really says, and so that women on the ground everywhere understand what it says, which is that male circumcision, if done in a medically supervised, sterile context, is 50 to 60% effective. That is, it reduces risk by that much of acquisition of HIV by men from an HIV-infected woman. So it doesn't yet say anything about whether women are protected from acquiring HIV infection from HIV-positive men. There's research underway to ascertain that, but we don't know that yet. So that's a really important message that community advocates as well as scientists have to be very specific about how we explain what the data do and do not say at this point.
I think we're going to need to wrap up, but that actually is a good note to end on because it shows how complex this whole endeavor of HIV prevention really is. And I encourage you to look at the report, to think about behavioral HIV prevention and how critical it is to any part of making a difference in this epidemic, whether or not we have a vaccine. Thank you very much for coming. We encourage you to read the report.